This is Infidel One. Offending Coyote Down. Offending Coyote Down.
Roger that.
Welcome to Trappin' Radio. We're proud, organic, free-range, wild fur farmers of North America.
Let me tell you a little story about how I was raised. Every day work, every day pray. God, family, friends, yeah, everybody sins. A winner never quits, and a quitter never wins. Help folks in need, don't fall for greed. A jealous man is weak, so think before you speak. If you love them, let them know. If you hate, let it go. Fast can be fun, but sometimes you need slow. God is all good, the devil is so real. So listen up, y'all, cause this is how I feel.
I won't back up, I don't back down. I've been raised up to stand my ground. Take my job, but not my guns. Tax my check till I ain't got none. Except for the good Lord up above. I answer to no one.
Now let's cover our sponsors. They do a lot to help support Trappin' Radio. So I'm asking you guys out there and gals to help support our sponsors as they keep Trappin' Radio on the air. First sponsors, Oki Cable and Trap Supply. Jeb's the owner of this. He's out of Oklahoma. Super guy. You'll not meet anybody nicer. It's somebody you're going to want to deal with. You can reach him at oktrapsupply.com. You can give Jeb a call at 918-429-4648. Not only does he do trap supply guys, he's a fur buyer, so if you're around the Oklahoma or surrounding states, give him a call with your fur. When you need stuff, give him a call and he'll get it out to you as soon as he can. Our second sponsor is F&T Fur Harvesters Trading Post. Everything you need for trapping, hunting with hounds, and predator calling. Guys, if you're into trapping fur, hunting fur, chasing fur with dogs, you're not going to be able to think of hardly anything that you can't get from F&T. You can reach them at fntpost.com. You can also give them a call at 989-727-8727. Whatever you want, F&T's got it. Wildlife Control Supplies, proven solutions for wildlife control, delivering value, expertise, and products to the wildlife individual. If you're in the ADC business, control business, even fur trapping, you need to look at these guys' website. Top-notch company, have everything you would want, even the odd stuff that ADC guys are looking for. You can reach them at wildlifecontrolsupplies.com. You can give them a call at 877-684-7262. International number is 860-844-0101. If you're a wildlife control professional, you need to have Wildlife Control Supplies as one of your favorites on your computer or your phone, because when you come across something that you need specialized equipment, Alan will get it right out to you. Now let's go trapping.
See, I'm a flag flying, Bible toting son of a gun. Yeah, I'm hell on the heart, just a rebel on the run. Scared, don't know it, fear, don't feel it. The truth is the light, sometimes you gotta fight. Good beats bad, right beats wrong. I'm a barroom preacher and this is my song. I'm climbing for the top, representing for the country. I'm the people's champ, right out to dead camp. Shotgun toter, Republican voter. Hank Jr. supporter, let's protect our border. To hell with anyone who don't believe in the USA. Cause this is what I say.
Well, hello, welcome to Trappin' Radio. This is your host, Clint Locklear, and we're going to be covering a menagerie of topics tonight. And before I do that, I need to give you full disclosure. As most of y'all know, from me talking about going to Thailand last week, been on an airplane for 36-something hours and stuff like that, apparently I have pinched a nerve coming out of my back. So I'm not sure exactly what's going to happen tonight, but they've got me on painkillers and muscle relaxers and all this stuff. So even though I think I'm going at a good clip, I may be really slow, and if that's the case, I apologize. But we're gonna rock on anyway. He tells me once the swelling goes down in this, it's not gonna be an ongoing thing. It's just trashed it in the airplane. So no big deal there. Now the other interesting thing before we get to topics, guys, the things you see when you're observant crack me up. Now on my farm that I bought, Travis helps me all the time. And one of the things on doing a permaculture style farm, we don't use chemicals, and I don't want to be using tractors and stuff like that. It's more like peasant farming type stuff. So I'm always looking for different ways to do different things. And one of my brother works at a pulpwood plant up in Charleston, Tennessee. And I asked him what do they do with the old belts. And what I mean by belts, some of these things are huge, long, some of them are half a mile long, made out of rubber, nylon, different things. I was looking at these for the simple purpose of weed control, or to put on the ground, completely kill the vegetation without chemical, just roll that thing back up, and then I could plant corn or cover crops or whatever in open ground without having to till or anything. So that was my idea. So my brother got me two of these rolls. One of these rolls is 5,000 pounds. One was 11,000 pounds. It's half inch rubber. It's 4 foot wide. One of them I know because we had to spread it out down at the farm. It's about 1,100 feet long, and it's heavy. So Travis, we rolled these things out and we're cutting them in 4 foot sections because they're really heavy. Well, the other day I'm down there and I'm checking on the progress of Travis cutting the rubber mats, how far he's got, just trying to, you know, plan ahead a little bit. And I'm driving down next to him, and there sits a turd blossom from a bobcat that looks like that thing must weigh 40 or 50 pounds. I mean, I would be impressed to pull this off. And I was like, that's crazy. The bobcat has crapped on this rubber mat. Now, this rubber mat's in the middle of about a 6.5, 8 acre field, I guess. Grown up, and these things just rolled out. Looks like a yellow brick road, but it's black. And I just noticed the cat dropping. I go down about 30 feet, and there's another cat dropping. And I go down about 100 feet from that, and there's a cat dropping that still looks shiny. So that cat, for whatever reason, and whatever this good'll do you as a trapper, I don't know, they started a toilet on this long rubber mat, which is amazing. Then when I get looking at it more closely, there's coyote tracks running up and down this mat. I mean, up and down, up and down, up and down this mat. Now I'm sitting there thinking, I've got a non-serious video that I'm probably putting on YouTube showing this, where, you know, if you want to catch coyotes and catch, you need 11,000 pounds of half inch rubber, 4 foot mat, roll it out in the field. But past that, guys, I don't know how you're going to catch them on there, because I just don't know how you would do it. But there's the option there, and some of y'all are probably way more creative and more intelligent than I am, so you can probably figure that out pretty well. But it's just amazing to me, when you keep your eyes open, the things you see that may or may not actually apply to anything, but it's just interesting how the cat started using that as a toilet and the coyotes are using it as a runway. Now, I'm assuming when we start pulling these mats up, because we put them there in, I think we unrolled them sometime this winter, so they've been there for a couple of months. I have a feeling when we start moving the mats, there's going to be a lot of mice under them, which would probably explain the coyotes more than anything, because the coyotes are going to smell the mice as they're going up and down. Sorry about that. Turned my phone volume down. Just one of those interesting things that whatever. So I've got some questions. We've got a fur report I'm going to do, on tonight's show. Now, if you want to send in a question, guys, it's really simple. You can email me at clint@wolfernation.com, or to even make it more personal, if you wanted to do it on the phone in audio, like you're going to hear the fur report and Jesse's question tonight, all you have to do is get on your phone, open it to where it can record, which most smartphones can do that. Talk into your phone. It'll save it as a file. And you just attach that file to an email and send it to me. And then if the question is, interesting, and it's got a good point to it. You know, don't ramble around on these things too much, and you know, kind of get to the point. It, to me, it just makes a more interesting show. Plus, I can pick up kind of what you're asking a little bit if it's more than text, if you follow what I'm saying. But the first question I want to answer tonight says, I'm in Wisconsin, in my area, I have a lot of gray fox and reds, but also a lot of coyotes. Is there a universal foot trap for them, and what size would you recommend? This comes from SA. I'm just say that. I don't like giving names out on online, but this is a weird subject for me. Personally, if you've never seen it, you can go to YouTube where I talk about the Tiny Trap Club. And I'm a believer in using bigger traps. I don't run away from that. I'm not ashamed of that. It just makes a lot of sense. I see a lot less damage with bigger traps than I do smaller traps. But there's always caveats to this. When you throw in a gray fox with coyotes, you're dealing basically with two crazy different size species. I mean, you're dealing with something that's it's tough as nails like a coyote, and you're dealing with something that's mentally tough as nails like a gray fox, but he's got a little leg bone that's about the size of your pinky. And when they run together, it's a lot harder to have a universal trap. Now, if I was going to give a recommendation on this, I would probably, that's a tough one. I would probably go with a number two dogless Bridger, or maybe even the 175 Bridger, the little square jaw trap. Randy Smith was using that in Maryland and had really good luck and actually caught several coyotes with it. And it's a strong little trap. He's modified them with a lamination and everything. But the number two Bridger, you know, get them modified right out of the box and go use them. I think that would probably be the best. Now, the thing, if you're going to use a generalized trap when you're dealing with something as small as gray fox to coyotes, do yourself a favor and run about 3 foot of chain with two or three swivels involved with that. A lot of time, the trap size on the gray fox, where the issue comes in is not so much the jaw size, it's the big trap with the weight, and then you're putting it on a short chain like a 10 or 12 inch stock chain. And with the animal being so short and so little, when he goes to fight the trap is binding all the time because he has such a little chain. Now, what I've learned with and I'm not talking a lot, I'm probably only talking about 20 gray fox in Texas when I'm using the CDRs, I've only had that I can recall one gray fox that hurt itself with a CDR, but I'm running 10 foot of chain. And the one that hurt itself got the trap wrapped up on a mesquite tree really close to the trap. And as he's fighting the trap, his little bone just couldn't handle it. But, you know, if you're going to be using a bigger trap around grays, try to keep them out of entanglement best you can and give them some room. And when you do that, a lot of the damage you get on the gray fox goes way, way down. Now, the other issue is trying to find a middle-of-the-road trap on this type thing. Is you're making a trap, you're trying to have a trap that's not really going to be good for either one. And that's normally where a lot of the issues come. So, to you know, a number two is fine for coyotes. A number three is definitely better. When I say three, I'm talking a 6.5 inch jaw spread. That's a coyote trap. That is a coyote trap. But for a little bitty gray fox, that's a huge monster trap. So if I was going to, you know, just use one, it'd probably be a number two or a 175 size trap. But by doing that, you're not going to have probably the best gray fox trap, and you're not going to have the best coyote trap. Which is one way that we could go about doing this, is just having a marginal trap on both animals. Now, the marginal part on the coyote is not just that it's a smaller trap or you need a bigger trap to hold a coyote. That's not true. Back in the day, I had a bunch of 1.5 Montgomerys, which was not even a full size 1.5 like a Victor was. It's actually smaller than that. And the big, thick, round jaws, I put number two music wire on there. I laminated them with number nine wire. I gave them 3 or 4 foot of chain. and I caught a pile of coyotes with that little bitty trap. Now, the issue's not holding the coyotes, guys. The issue is missing the coyotes. That's where the marginal part comes in when you're using such a small trap. Not that the trap can't do it. You know, and I know there's going to be guys, well, if you're a good trapper, you know where he's going to put his foot. And all I've got to say to that is, what a bunch of horse crap. A coyote is not going to do the same thing, just like you're not going to do the same thing when you go do everything in your life. You don't know exactly what the coyote's going to do. You can hope, you can surmise, you can come up with a theory or a hypothesis if you want to, but you don't really know. You can guide them, leave them open, you can do whatever. The best you're doing as a trapper is getting close. That's really the best way to do it, because if you're trying to force it to do what you want to do, you're probably getting it too tight for a coyote, and then he's just not going to work your set. So you've got to think about that. So to me, the best thing to do, SA, is, that's kind of funny. It sounds like a Mexican name, and it's definitely not. But S period, A period. Okay. What I would probably do is I would use number two Bridger Douglas when I was doing sets for coyotes. And I would do the sets for coyotes by having the trap back a good 10 or 12 inches, give the gray fox plenty of room to get up there and steal your bait and cause you heartache and all that other type stuff, but then go over 5 or 6 feet and put in a gray fox set with a 1.5. That's all you need for a gray fox. And put that thing up tight. Now, by doing this, you're gonna miss most of your coyotes at your gray fox sets, and you're gonna miss most of your gray fox at your coyote sets. It's not 100%, but neither is using a marginal trap. And sometimes you will catch a coyote with the trap up really, really close to the hole, but you're gonna have a lot more that's not gonna get caught. And the gray fox could, in theory, work around and get caught by the back foot in your coyote size trap. So that could definitely happen, no doubt. But your chances are way down. See, I know this because if I go to somewhere like North Carolina or places that have lots of gray fox and I'm there to do coyote work, I hardly ever catch gray fox in my coyote sets. See, I'm not trying to do a marginal generic dirt hole. They're set specifically for coyotes. And the trap is normally going to be somewhere between that 10 and 14 inch pan center, pan to the side, wherever I think they're going in. But the trap's going to be that far back. And the gray fox is going to get up there close to that hole and have a party. Now, if I want to catch the gray fox, then I have to move the trap farther up, which makes it not that good of a set for a coyote. So to me, the best answer is to put in gray fox sets and put in coyote sets and have them very different. For that purpose. So instead of going out and trying to do the generic for everything, be more specific. That way you're going to be gentler on the gray fox and you can have the equipment you need on the coyote. And that just makes a lot better sense to me, just from a practical point of view. But either way that you do it, because you may not can, you know, I don't know what your financial needs are. You know, you may not be able to afford to go buy two different sets of traps or something like that, but you know, you don't need a lot of power for a gray fox. So that's just kind of what I'm thinking anyway. So there you go.
Now this is Jeff Dunlap with.
Well, that happened quicker than I thought it would. We're going to go to the fur report from Jeff. He's got some interesting news. I'll get the volume about right. And then Jeff Dunlap, give him the fur report, guys.
Hi, this is Jeff Dunlap with Trappin' Radio's Fur Report. What we're going to be covering this week is the March 12th sale, which was a fur harvester's auction sale. It went pretty good. I mean, there's bright spots, there's bad spots, but hey, that's a fur sale. Everything's going to be, you know, mishmash in there. So we're going to go over some of the prices, and I'll tell you my thoughts on some of it as we go. There was 28,138 beaver on that auction. 76% of the first section Eastern sold for a 1442 average. 75% of the first section Western sold, and they average a 10.24. 81% of the section 3 average $9. Which those are the, you know, the lesser beaver, junk, flat, you know, whatever. Caster, grade number 1, $66 a pound. Grade number 2, $56 a pound. Grade number 3, $45 a pound. Mink, 100% of the northern mink sold for $13.42. Central males, 98% sold for $12.37. And the females, 100% sold for a $7.27, which is just about half of the, right around half of the males. So the male mink prices have come up this year a little bit. Last year I sold mine, I think I averaged like $7-$8, something like that. So, you know, it's not the $20. We want mink to at least be above, but hey, it's better than last year. Otters. There was 3,548 otters on this sale. 66% sold. First section, $31.99 average, $68 tops. We don't know what the, you know, what otter they sold. I should say, I don't know what otter that they sold. The state sales were averaging that and better. So, you know, if there's any state sales in your area, we'll wait and see what happens with this NAFA sale and then the Fort Harvesters one. But it's still better than the $15, $10 and $15 they were offering last year. But I'd still like to see, you know, otters in that $50 range. I mean, I would like a $200 range, but, you know, at least in that $50 range. Years ago, say, like in the 80s and stuff, you know, that, if you got an otter, it would have to be a real junk otter for it not to be worth $50. You know, that's about what the going rate here and where I live was. If you caught an otter, you just figured it was $50. And things were a lot cheaper then. Fishers, 78%. Sold of the females, $69.29, 100% of the males, $57.61. So I know you New York guys out there like to see that pop up a little bit, and I don't blame you. Lynx cats. For you out there who don't know what lynx cat is, I'm going to give you the scientific name that I've given them, bobcats. So bobcats slash lynx cats. It was 4,053 on that sale. 100% of the Western Heavy sold for a $527.38 average. 100% of the Western Semis, $314.89. 100% of the Canadian sold, $80.99. 92% of the Northern sold, $84.78. With a top on the Bobcats, you know, their, you know, top lot crap. Average $1,500, which would never ever would I get anywhere I trap, so it never would affect me. On otters, I've gotten it, but and then it's nice. Then I don't think it's crap because you get more money. See, red fox. It was 6,543 red fox. 100% of the eastern sold for a $27.70 average. 35% of the northern for a $26.07 average. 47% of the Western sold for a 1973 average. 77% of the Central sold for a 1202 average. Now, I know you guys, especially out in Maryland, Pennsylvania, areas of Pennsylvania, you know, like to see that red fox market up. I don't blame you at all. I want to see you guys, you know, be able, you know, everyone you catch, just sell it 100% and get good money out of them. So I like, you know, hopefully that red fox market will go up a little bit. On another fox market, gray fox, there was 4,240, which I think is a bright spot. They didn't sell 100%, only 70% sold. But, you know, last year it seemed like the grays just sat dead. And it's different years we've seen that where the grays, you know, sat dead and they sell a small percentage of them. But they averaged $17.72, high of $33. So you southern guys better get out there and get them. Coyotes, which I'm sure there's some interest in what coyotes did. 16,440 were presented at the sale, 100% sold to the Western Heavies for $102.06. 100% of the Western Semi Heavies sold for $57.42. 79% of the Eastern sold for $26.86. 66% of the Central sold for $15.72. Top lot for the Western Heavy Cayutes was $170. I'm assuming there was a Western Heavies, since they are the, you know, the money Cayutes. They on some of them, yeah, we'd like to see the prices come up, and I mean, who doesn't want more money? But you know what? They're selling for 100%, 79%. I mean, it's not what we want. But you know what? It's better than what we've gotten in the past on some years, and I think it's all encouraging. The next one I'm really encouraged about. I'm sure there's some guys that think, you know, this won't be spectacular, but I see it as a bright spot, considering what people were saying what we were going to get for coon last September, October. That I heard, oh, they're never going to come back. You know, people were selling coon for $1, $2 on the big ones. So, 83,441 were on this sale of raccoons. 51% of the Canadians sold at $6.49. 97% of the Northeast Heavies sold for $9.23. 97% of the Western Heavies sold for $11.86. 76% of the Western Semi sold for $5.23. 85% of the North Central sold for $10.74. High $40. So we'll have to wait and see what happens on this NAFA sale. I'm sure they'll have a bigger collection of coon than what Fur Harvesters had on theirs. They'll give us kind of an idea what we're going into, you know, for the Russians. That was the other thing, is on their printout, Fur Harvesters said that, you know, the Russians were involved. And don't tell the Democrats that the Russians were involved in buying these coon. We can't afford to lose one coon sale. So let's just keep this hush hush on the Russians being involved deal, okay? Ermine / weasel, 7,760 were on the sale, 44% sold. Overall average was 255, high of $12. I personally think that every weasel should be worth 12 bucks, 12 to 20. Don't take less than 20. I just think weasels are cool. I like trapping them. I'd probably go out there and trap them full time if they were worth 20 bucks. Not probably, I would be. Squirrels. These are like the red squirrels, pine squirrels. They call them different things in different areas. We got them up here in the northern states. I never seen any in the southern states when I was trapping down there or out west, southwest. But the squirrels, it was 5,558, 14% sold, 81 cent average. So high at $1.21. So basically the squirrels kind of look like what the coon market did last year and in September. So you sell about 14%, get 81 cents. You know, things are a lot better. Skunks, 240 was on that sale. Which, you know, there's thousands out of everything else. The skunks isn't that many compared to the percentage-wise. 93% sold, so if you set them up there, you had a real good chance of them selling. If they were mine, I'd be in the 7%, of course. The overall sale average was 525, high of 1350. So at 525 with a skunk, it's kind of went down a little bit in price as far as the essence. A lot of guys are paying $10, some less, some more. But say you get half an ounce out of a skunk, so you get, say, $5, for the hide. So you got, $10 for a skunk, 10 to 12 bucks. You can't beat that. And I know they stink, but, we're trappers. Suck it up. Muskrats. I think that muskrats are going to, do better on that. They put my mace mainly on sold, I think, because of Fur Harvesters waiting to hold on to them to see what's going to happen, later on. I think the buyers didn't want to pay as much as what they wanted for them and knew that they were worth. Because if there is a shortage of rats like I thought there would be this year, then they're going to be worth more. But they mainly went unsold. And like I say, I was so convinced on rats this year that I sent a bunch of my winter rats I saved from last year up there. And I think that they're going to do good. I think the whole thing looks up compared to what we were told in, say September, October. So get out there and, smoke you some fur. I know a lot of your guys' seasons are out. You have what you have. But that's the thing is why you're the guys that went out there and trapped this year that are going to trap next year and capitalize on the market if it does go up. But you're also, when the prices go up like now, when there wasn't a lot of guys out there, you're going to benefit. Because that's when it's going to, the prices are going to rise. We had the big fur harvest in 2 and 3 years ago, carried that fur over, finally started selling, and now you guys got fresh stuff put on the market, and you're going to be the big winners, I believe, because of that on a lot of this stuff. And just plan. Like next year, we don't know what's going to happen, but be out there trapping. Try and figure out the best you can. If you think rats will be up and you have rats in your area, target them. Target, if you're going for money, target the stuff that, you think is going to be up. If you just like doing it, go out and trap whatever you like. That's the way it should be. Just have fun doing it. Thanks a lot for listening. If I find anything out before the NAFA sale, kind of what's going on, we'll put up an update. If not, I'll be putting it up after the NAFA sale, and then we'll do another one after the fur harvester sale and kind of get a gear of what's going on here. Well, thanks a lot for listening, and I'll see you after the NAFA sale.
Well, thank you, big man. Jeff, he puts a lot of time into thinking about this, and you should really, I just think this is a cool idea because it's not about what everybody wants the fur to be, it's what it is. And that's one thing I really like about what Jeff's doing. I will have one small thing to say about Jeff. I have a little bit of a disagreement with what he said during the podcast, and he knows I love him to death, so I don't think it's going to be an issue, but he says beaver are worth X. Now, beaver are worth X only to the trapper that doesn't understand beaver. And I'm not saying Jeff doesn't, but I'm just saying it's a different mentality of looking at it. Now, let's say you go catch a beaver and it brings $10. Everybody gets down in the mouth about $10. But see, beaver to me is not worth $10. It's worth about $57 to $60. And I'm going to explain to you how that is. It's really, really simple. And you may kind of turn your nose up about what I'm getting ready to say or not believe it or whatever, but it, to me, it's true because it's just the way that it is in my world. You get $10 for a beaver, and then you can go to Wolfer Nation on my YouTube channel where I show making beaver with pesto over Parmesan cheese quinoa, which is something that, guys, if it was in a restaurant, not that we go to these kind of restaurants very often, that meal right there would have cost you $25-$30. It's that good. I show you how to cook it. It's not that difficult. So beaver. Another thing, I've got a video on there talking about deer roast. It's called a Mississippi roast. Beaver in that is amazing. And if you're worried that your wife or your girlfriend or you's not going to like beaver, I'm going to give you the description of beaver from my wife. When she had it with nothing on it the other day, she was just curious. She tasted it and she was amazed because it was milder than beef. So, it's milder than ground beef. There's no gaminess to it at all unless you do something to screw it up or you let it sit in a trap for a long time or something. So beaver by itself is very mild. So when I look at a beaver, and I know what just grass-fed ground beef would cost, which is what I normally try to get, that's about $7 a pound. So I'm going to say in the pesto, beaver and pesto recipe, I had about 5 pounds of beaver. So that means that's 35 pounds of meat. Now, you can make money by getting money, or you can make money by not spending money. So to me, they're the same. That's $35 worth of meat on top of a $10 hide. Then you throw the caster at the price it is, you're talking about probably $12 for, you know, big healthy set of caster, it's going to bring you up to $57-$60 for a beaver. Now, if the price of the beaver hide was worth $60, people would be fighting themselves and getting in fist fights on the trap line to get their share of the beaver. And that's that way now anyway. Now, if you want to get really technical with this, and you're in a place where you're doing a little bit of beaver control, and you throw another $50 or $100 on top of that, now the beaver's worth $150 apiece. If you can't get excited over $150 beaver, I don't know how to help you. I really don't. But even $57 beaver, I can get pretty excited over that. And I can tell you, for beaver, for me, there are four beavers scheduled every month in our house to eat. Regardless of the fur market, regardless what's going on outside of that. There's four beaver that is scheduled to be trapped fresh every month, 12 months out of the year, just for our kitchen. So when I say that about the meat, it's not just a theoretical thing, it's a real life thing. So just thinking about that a little bit. But I do, besides that, I think Jeff was spot on. And he was just telling you the facts when he was doing that. Now, this next one is kind of weird, guys. You may be interested in this, you not. Now, Jim, I'm going to send you an email when we get off of here, or call you to see what you want to do. He bought some trees from me last year. As most of y'all know, I like growing stuff, so I grew out some pawpaw trees, and I think he bought some other stuff, I'm not sure. Anyway, he sent an email where he wanted 20 pawpaws, which I can't get rid of because of the system I'm putting in for my own deer harvesting production on my farm. So, but Jim, I can send you 10 of the pawpaws and 20 of the persimmons. The pawpaws will be 8 apiece, and the persimmons will be 7. Now, the reason I'm bringing this up, guys, I'm sitting on about 100 grown American persimmon trees that I can get rid of outside of my own system. If y'all are into deer hunting or wildlife or something like that, and you want some trees at $7 a piece that are healthy, and then you just go plant them out and you shouldn't have any problems whatsoever, email me at Clint@WolferNation, and then let me know how many you get. Like I said, I only have about 100 because I'm putting out another 70 on my place, but I've only got about 100 that I can turn loose. So if you're interested, let me know that. The shipping on these won't be too bad. What I'll do is I'll prune them to where they're no more than 3.5 feet tall for the boxes, so I can ship them out UPS. So if you're interested, just let me know, or you can call me at 423-949-5273. And that way we can get your trees. But if you want them, they're going to be bare root, which means I need to get them to you within the next week or so. So don't drag your feet. And if I don't sell them this way, I'll probably have some of them at the show. So just keep that in mind. Now, the next question that I want to go to is, these are some interesting, not easy questions. And that's kind of what I like, you know, because it, Brian Cole, questions, let's see, questions about trapping. Okay, I have a couple of questions for you. This is Ryan C. I have a couple questions for you. I have an ADC business in East Texas. I have a contract on 12-mile long private lake, different things. And what he's running into, the question is, recently some nutrients moved into the lake, the fish hatchery ponds, and caused major damage. I was about to shoot a lot of them and caught a few in blind sets. When they drain the pond, the nutria move off to different parts of the lake. Every once in a while, I catch or see them in different parts of the lakes. So I mostly target beaver. I charge them per animal, so it'd be nice in my best interest to catch more nutria. That's the truth. I was wondering if you could recommend a lure or bait to catch them. I really can't find anything that is marketed for nutria. I would like to start making a few sets for them in the areas where I am beaver trapping. Now, as far as I know, this is all conjecture. I'm not a nutria trapper. Most of the time when I'm in areas like North Carolina, Louisiana, Mississippi, and I'm catching nutria, I'm pretty much throwing a hissy fit because a nutria has this unnatural ability to screw with an otter trapper. So what happens is you see your trap gone and you look down in the water, and when you're and if the and the nutria is facing up, its whiskers and everything under the water, your brain automatically sees otter, then you pull it out, and then it's like something just kicks you right in the gonads because it's a nutria and it's not an otter. So I can't say that I've got the most love for these animals because they play tricks on me all the time. Now, we don't have them here, at least where I'm at, thank goodness. So I'm not the nutria expert. I've never went after nutria by myself, but I have talked to some guys in Louisiana that have. And the way that they trap the nutria basically is blind sets, like what you're talking about. The nutria come out on the bank to eat, and they leave what looks to be a mixture between a muskrat run and a beaver run. It's a little bit smaller than a beaver. It's usually not worn down as much because they're not going up and clearing out forest. What they're doing is they're going up and they're getting vegetation off the bank. Now, I'm not sure what type of vegetation's in the water. It depends on where you're at in East Texas, but it looks like you've got a lot of stuff that grows right on the edge and right up in the middle. So if I was going to do it, I would go with the guys that catch thousands of nutria, and I would kind of go about it their way. Any type of trail that comes out of the water, they're slamming in a 220. And they run a lot of them. But they're not spending a lot of time on the sets either. That's the beauty of this system. So it's not going to be a high percentage set. So like I wouldn't go out and try to set three traps to catch three nutria. I don't think it works that way. But what they're doing is they'll go around these ponds, and everywhere it looks like something's coming by the water, they just slam a 220 in it. And when they're in Louisiana doing this, some nights they're catching, you know, 100 to 300 nutrias going about this system, and they're setting hundreds of traps to do it. You know, and if you've got the 220s, you could use 330s, 280s, probably get away with 160s. You know, whatever it is that you have there, you know, just plop them down in there. Now, if you're going to try to lure or bait these, they're more like a muskrat than they are a beaver. So if that's the case, just knowing that about them, because the way they eat the grass and the plants up on the bank like muskrats do, I would look at some of the more well-known muskrat lures, honestly, and just test them out and see. And it's going to be a hit or miss, I'm sure, different ones that you can find out there. One of the ones that I've used a lot is the O'Gorman makes it, and it's called it's like Country Boy Muskrat Lure or something like that. You'll see it. It's an unusual name for him. It's more of a liquid. On dry land, it'd be perfect. In the water, if you have any boat traffic, it gets washed off a little bit. But it's a good one. The one that's from Michigan, Muskrat All Call, is a good one. And I'm sure there's plenty of them out there. I mean, I've never been that big of a muskrat lure type guy. You know, I've been playing around with lures and stuff with it. But those are the two that if I'm going out really getting serious, Farm Boy Specials, Farm Pond Special, I think that's the O'Gorman one, something like that off the top of my head. That one does really well, and the Muskrat All Call does really well. But there's probably many different ones. But I would go with the muskrat lures. And as far as for bait, I mean, I would seriously look at getting some turnips or rutabagas or something like that, something that you can get cheap, and just try, you know, slicing those things up and putting it in places they can see, you know, and catch them. Now, since they're like a muskrat, and you're being from Texas, which probably means you don't have a lot of muskrat experience, if you think about muskrats or muskrat trapping instead of beaver trapping, don't forget the parallel edges, the perpendicular edges on creeks and ponds and stuff like that. And what I mean by that, if you've got a straight up and down bank and you've got at least 6-8 inches of water, I would put a trap that's going to be perpendicular to that, so it sticks out in the water. And then you can kind of block it down. And that's another really simple set that doesn't take a lot of time, especially if you're using stands. If you've got an overhanging bank, nutria would be just like a muskrat as far as wanting cover and stuff, because stuff likes to eat nutria. Bobcats love nutria meat. So I would do that, and depending on what your banks look like, if you have the straight up and down banks, I'd be looking at things that kind of push them in an area. Like if you've got a bank that's kind of going down and it's kind of straight up and down, and you got a little log or the bank's a little more straight up and down in one place and it sticks out farther in the other, the most outside point in the water, that's where I'd put the trap. And if you've got plenty of 330s, Ryan, I would stick those in there. You'll pick up some beaver that way anyway, but that's a really unique way to catch muskrats. I do it a lot here on the river where the bank's straight up and down, you have an overhanging. I just slam in traps under there and the muskrats will go under there for cover and feed and everything, and they get smacked. So it works very well that way. But I would definitely, if you're getting paid to catch them, I mean, I would turn into the absolute nutria dude. Because if they're moving in there, man, they're moving in everywhere else. And they do. They cause a lot of damage. They're like a muskrat on steroids as far as what they do to the banks. So you may have a ready-made business plan showing up that you've never thought about. So you could snare. I don't see why you couldn't snare nutria. Actually, as I think about it, I'd get little bitty kill poles like 3 foot tall, and I'd run 1/16 cable, and you could go down a bank, especially if you use fiberglass. I mean, you could carry so many of those, and you could just push them in, open the loop, push them in, open the loop, push them in, open the loop, and you could set up a whole area in just a little bit. That's the way I would go about it anyway. But there again, keep all this in mind. I am not a nutria guy, and I don't want to. Give the impression that I am, because I think that's dishonest. So the next question I'm going to go to is from Jesse, which this is a question that not quite sure.
Hey, Clint. Let's try this recording again. Hopefully this time you can hear me. Yeah. I think...
Okay. Before I get to his question, he asked me something in an email that I just want to get out there. Most of y'all know that I'm into permaculture and weird hippie farming and stuff like that, and he asked a book. Now, he's read a book from a guy named Mark Shepherd of Regenerative Agriculture. He wanted to know about some other ones. So I'm sitting at my desk, and I'm looking at my books. So I'm going to say a few of these real quick. The Bible of Permaculture is the Designer's Manual by Bill Mollison. But it is a manual. It is not a book like Regenerative Agriculture. It is a how-to manual. The second one that I would recommend is the first and second series of Edible Forest Landscapes by Town Holzman. And then Gala's Garden is a really good one. Edible Forest Gardens. The Ultimate Guide to Permaculture. And then Ben Falk has, you just have to Google Ben Falk book, and he's got a really good one. And if you read those, Jesse, you'll probably have more information than you ever wanted to have. And if you want to have a hoot, go to Jeff Lawton's website, and you can order a 1983 permaculture design course from Bill Mollison. I promise you, you'll have a hoot if you do that. So we're going to get to this question, which is about coon and truffles, and it's two things I never thought I'd hear in the same sentence.
Going, I was talking to you. I had my coat on, and it was windy that day. So hopefully this time we'll have a better chance of getting my question across. So, my question, what's it about is... It's a question on truffles and also coons at the same time. So let me kind of give you some background to this. I was doing some timber work, and as I was marking the trees to which, trees to save, which ones to cut, I'm noticing I have these, random piles of coon scat throughout the timber, which was kind of odd because it's not a very good oak timber. There's quite a few red oaks here and there, quite a few white oaks here and there, but mostly hickory. Yeah, and I think, maybe the coons eat are in here because of the hickory nuts, but you know, it's a big timber and there's a pine on the property and there's cornfields all the way around it. So, you know, it makes sense if the coons are just living there and, excuse me, and going to the crop fields for their, you know, other use. However, as I walk through the timber, these coon scat piles, they line up. It's like little, they're scout markers. And that's the best way I can describe, because they just go up and down, and through one side, like to the south side, to the north side, and it's just scat randomly. Not randomly, it looks like it's, you know, marked. And I guess this is kind of a two-part question, but are the coons doing that because it's a territory marker, or it's like a kind of a thing for coons to tell the other coons, hey, go this way, there's food up here? Because I know, like, coons, they follow each other's trails because there's a marker up ahead. Like in Iowa, they look for telephone poles. Those telephone poles is the only thing those coons can see from such a low level. No, if I use that pole on this trail, it'll take me to corn or whatever. But on a deeper question, though, because animals can sometimes show us stuff that we didn't realize about before, I'm going to kind of sidestep here for a second. Being that, okay, I've gotten really into mycology or mushrooms, and in some of my research, I've came across truffles. And, you know, most people know the truffles from France and Italy, northern Spain, where they have these, you know, $3,000, $4,000, $5 for a pound of these truffles. Well, we do have them here in America. Oregon is one of the highest paying truffles in the whole country, that part of the Pacific Northwest. And they go for about $1,000 a pound, which is sort of really amazing. Here, and this is a question for you, because you're down more in pecan country than I am, and I'm kind of looking at pecan natural habitat. I'm not that far off. However, the Midwest and the South in Texas have a truffle called pecan truffle. It was discovered on a Texas orchard, pecan orchard. And those pecans and truffles have a symbiotic relationship. But those pecan truffles, for a pound, they go for $300. And you and I have had a recent conversation about planting pecans, and I'm thinking, oh, it'd be kind of cool to see if I get pecan trees inoculated with truffles. But anyway, what I'm trying to get at is, Clint, we may have them here in Iowa, but the pecan truffles. And they do grow amongst pecan trees and oak trees, but also means they grow amongst hickories. And maybe walnuts, maybe, you know, because walnuts, hickories, and pecans, they're all in the same family. I believe hickories and pecans are in a similar genus. And honestly, I'm not quite sure the different categories. I need to refresh up on that. But so we know that for sure that these truffles grow on pecan roots, hickory roots, and even maybe black walnut roots. But to lead back up with the coons, you know, I've been looking for these truffles, and some of the signs they say to look for at the base of a hickory tree. Or some certain trees that may have good fungal activity, you'll see white mycelium in the bark, which mycelium is just a vegetative state of the mushroom, for those that don't know. And there's other signs too, digging, but digging's kind of everything digs in the woods. It could be turkey, it could be deer, it could be squirrels, you never know. But anyway, but what's got me wondering is, you know, where these coons are crapping at, their scat, they were mostly on pignut hickory or the shellbark hickory, and that's virtually, in my opinion, it doesn't have any worth wildlife-wise, maybe for squirrels, but it has no timber value at all. It's a worthless tree to most foresters. But I noticed a lot of those white blotches, the mycelium on those trees, I recall seeing coon scat on around the base of those trees. So I'm wondering if the coons are telling me something. Maybe they're marking their, you know, territory, or maybe marking for, you know, I guess like a scout marker for another coons. Or they simply know there's a really high nutritious truffle in this ground, and I'm gonna, this is, yeah, we're just gonna go bonkers and mark this up. I don't know. I'm just, it just seems like a big coincidence to me, but maybe I'm the right page, and we just don't know about it yet. And I guess that can open a whole other can of worms. If you notice other animals, anything similar to this, if I'm on the right page, or I'm way off down the rabbit hole, smack dab middle of the Tea Party of the Mad Hatter. I don't know. And I guess if you have any other experience with critters and mushrooms or something similar to this, or if I'm on the right page, let me know. Appreciate it, good sir. We'll catch you later.
Well,
hey, Clint.
That is the oddest question I've ever had to think about. And it's interesting. I have heard that turkeys will eat mushrooms, and I've heard that squirrels can call some that will eat certain mushrooms, sometimes even shiitakes and different things like that. So animals definitely eat them. I have no doubt about that. I don't know which animals do. It wouldn't surprise me that a raccoon would. But, you know, thinking about the coons, when we're thinking about this, and not just for you, Jesse, but anybody else, you know, when you're thinking about den trees for coons, you got to keep the pattern of what's going on with their life cycle at the time. Now, we go out early fall because that's when we start trapping, and then you've got sign in the woods, and you got to keep in mind, like I said, I'm sure you already know this, Jesse, but raccoons, it seems like from guys that do a lot of raccoon hunting, they come out at dusk, they eat, and they climb up in trees and crap, and they just hang out, and they kind of, you know, that's kind of mostly what they do all night, and then they get kind of active again in the morning. So if there's a food source around, which could be, you know, some type of late fruiting or some type of nut, or could even be mushrooms, I guess. Once they get done filling their stomach, they just kind of, you know, sit up and they crap out of trees and hang out, different things like that. Now, the denning trees, they only seem to use, at least what it seems like, you know, is going to be when they have young and when it's really cold. So they're not using those all the time when you're looking at, because I can tell you that I've set a lot of stuff in the woods where I come across what looks like a lot of coon activity from old sign and somewhat fresh sign, and I've been very disappointed by doing that, setting that way. I mean, it's, and I know what you're talking about. You come across a bunch of coon scat around a tree somewhere, and you're trying to figure out why are they here, what are they doing. You know, and then I'll put some sets in. I've never had very much luck doing that. Not saying that I just hadn't figured it out yet. So I really don't know. But as far as them using them for markings, I would say just the pragmatist part of me would go, they're probably going north, south, east, west, whatever they're doing, going to a food source, and they're kind of hanging in the same path, or, you know, the general path, and they're just taking a dump. Then we come behind it later on, and we're just seeing all this sign in like a line, like what it sounds like you're describing. So we're thinking it could be something more than it is. And it could be, I don't know. I've never got the impression that raccoons do the marking thing kind of like coyotes do. I've never studied that either. So I want to keep that clear, that I really don't know about that. Now, the truffle thing, if they are, dude, and you've got them in your area, you need to get you a pet raccoon and train that thing. That's what I would be trying to figure out, or find out someone that knows, which should be a tough one, but you'd have to find someone that knows how to train a dog to, you know, there's dogs that I know that they train to dig ginseng. You know, get horns. You got guys know how to do that. I don't know how you would get the actual truffle part for the training of that, but if you could get a dog that could go out and knew what a truffle was and just went out and see if he would find one, I think that'd be amazing. Now, the problem is there's not too many truffle hunters in America that I know about, so I don't know where you get one of these dogs at. You know, one thing about the mycelium is you're talking, I use a lot of organic matter when I'm planting stuff out. So I'm using a lot of old hay and leaf mold and wood chips and everything like that. And I was just over at the farm yesterday, and I've got all kind of crazy mushrooms because it's warmed up. We had a bunch of rain. I got mushrooms growing everywhere, and I don't know what it is. But when you look at a lot of that material underneath where you have these blooms, you do have all this mycelium that's structured all in there. So my question that I would just have to ask from a logical point of view, is there a lot of broken down organic material around the base of these trees, and is that what's causing the mycelium to come up? You know, because you have all different kinds. You've got stuff that grow mushrooms, you've got stuff that break down dead wood. You know, there's mushrooms are kind of like a whole culture that we don't know that much about. So, and I'm definitely one of them people when it comes to that. But if it is the pecan truffle that you're talking about, which I've never heard of, by the way, but you definitely have my attention on this. If you can't find, which I've never heard of anybody that can grow truffles in some type of controlled environment like you can shiitakes or, you know, the different type of mushrooms that we eat, like oyster mushrooms. So, you know, inoculating could be tough. But just for your own personal thing, what I would do if it was me and this is something I was interested in doing, I would probably call down to one of the nurseries in Texas where they have these, explain that you're not interested in digging their mushrooms or doing anything like that. Just tell them, you know, I'm a long way from you. I'm just curious what it looks like or how do you find them. You know, as you know, what's it look like on the side of the trees? That way you can get a better view and drive down there and see. Most guys like that, if it's not during their busy season and you don't come across like a lunatic, which I don't think you would, they'd probably go, yeah, sure, come on down and take a look around because it's not going to hurt anything. Now, if I could get down there, Jesse, what I would do is once they found out that I wasn't a crazy person and that I'm just interested in this, I would try to figure out a way where they would allow me to scrape or get, you know, a couple of handfuls of soil around from each one of these trees that they think the truffles are growing at, bring it back home, and then put that in the hole where I planted the pecans. And hopefully some of that would have survived and would grow. Because I have a feeling the pecan tree is not exactly what's causing this stuff to grow on there. I have a feeling it's somewhere in history, somewhere where these pecan farms, they got inoculated with some type of soil or dirt or biochar or something like that that had this in there and it's compatible with the pecan tree. And if you can get some of this dirt, and it does seem to work, and you want to try to do something besides just pecans, I would definitely stick with the hickories. It's a lot closer to the pecan, and you don't have some of the harsh chemicals that come off of a black walnut that may mess this stuff up. So I'm not sure I'd start with a black walnut, but I would do the other. But I think it'd be a cool thing to be like the pecan truffle dude in the, you know, in the spring, and then you trap in the winter. I mean, that's like right up the revenue stream type thing. You know, if you could pull it off, $300 a pound, if you could inoculate enough stuff. The cool thing about a revenue stream like this, if you could figure out how to get that started around some trees and just continually move that dirt, if it'll work, to other trees, you could probably have... It's not like someone's going to be able to come in and steal it like ginseng. I mean, it's, you know, or morel mushrooms or something like that. It's going to have to be somebody that's specifically knowing what's going on, and you probably wouldn't have very much competition with that at all. You know, it is definitely something I would look at. You know, one of the things I would definitely want to know from these pecans, are they growing certain types of grass? You know, is it compatible? Are they mulching? Are they chopping and dropping? Are they using hay or wood chips? You know, you want to recreate what they're doing if you try to get some of this dirt back to your place so you're giving it the same thing. You know, just is it a lot drier there? Is a lot moisture there? You know, can you play with irrigation to get it kind of close? That's the type of things I'd be looking at for me personally. But if the raccoons, I mean, you're talking about making scouting a lot more interesting. If what you're saying could be true, and you're out scouting for raccoons and marking trees to dig truffles later, I mean, you're talking about a rocking way to make a living. That would be extremely, extremely cool. So we're going to go down, and this is a question that I guarantee you most people would not answer on a podcast publicly. So, business idea. Where's this one at? Okay, this is one from Michael T. And it's an interesting thing, but I think this would be a good... We'll just think about this one out loud a little bit. And, you know, if this is something that other guys seem interested in, there's probably a way that we could pull this off somehow or another. So... If it seems like something you would actually be interested in, then I would definitely look at it. So I've got an idea. I wondered if you and guys like F&T, Jeff Dunlap, have ever considered. First, I'd like to tell you a little about my trapping, why I had this idea. I'm not a pro trapper or fur trapper. See, I'm not a pro trapper or fur trapper, mostly a guy. Oh, just learned to get rid of some coyotes on my property. Word seemed to travel fast around hunting clubs. Hey, there's these guys know how to trap coyotes. Kind of made me the go-to guy here in South Alabama, at least in my part. No one seems to trap. Most folks don't know anything about trapping at all. People start asking me to show them how, kind of the point, and point them in the right direction. As to traps, baits, lures, websites, best dealers, and products, I hand out old F&D catalogs and such. I noticed when I would see these guys again, they had purchased baits, lures, traps, etc., that I'd recommended, and I had faith in your products, and these folks were happy with their success as well. This made me think, and this is a good thing, guys, to always be thinking. Because I listen to your radio show and Meat Trappers show about income streams, have you, F&T, or Jeff ever considered teaming up and to do maybe like a network marketing type sales approach, almost like Avon or something like that, where a guy like myself could purchase a package of catalogs or samples of some of the type of products that we use, and say we could have a code on them, could earn a small percentage off what the guys order if they refer that they got it from us. We know when they place an order. It was just an idea. Not sure if it'd work in trapping or not. Just thought I'd pass along the idea. Thanks for your time and all the true info you put out online. That's an interesting... That's an interesting concept for sure. Now, logistically, what you're going to run into most of the time is that how do you track it? Now, you've got guys that are very good with tracking mechanisms. F&T could definitely pull this off. I know I could pull this off. Dunlap, it didn't meet his business model, which I'm not going to get into. But there's other people that could. Now, so if I follow what you're saying, so like you would be like an independent salesperson where you would hand out a catalog or give someone a website and probably have a code. See, me, I don't have catalogs, so that wouldn't work on the catalogs. But if you had a code, you know, like... MT Alabama, for say, you know, that was the code, and they had that code, and then in my website, when someone used that code, it would be tracked, which that would be easy to do, and then say, like, at the end of the month, it'd be a 10% referral fee on the sale. Now, that's probably doable. As far as trying to do something like Avon, I really don't know what that's like. I have got hooked up with Amway about 30 years ago, and I don't think that would work very well, but I mean, I guess something like that could. It's an interesting concept. Now, if you're gonna try to do that, I mean, you could contact somebody and go, you know, pitch them the idea and just do what it is. Now, here's the deal. If to be realistic about this, if I were going to do that with somebody, it would have to be somebody that I knew was actually going to go out and hustle. Like, it, to me, it wouldn't really be worth the tracking, the aggravation, the writing a few checks and stuff like that if it's only going to be 3 or 4 sales a year. I mean, that's just honest. Now, if someone were to go out and build, you know, WordPress websites where it didn't cost a lot of money, they put out some content, they might have do, you know, YouTube videos or something like that with this code in there, then all of a sudden I show up Monday morning and I've got 14 different sales with this code in it, you would have my attention very, very quickly when it comes to that. To see, that's a lot different than just, you know, if I see somebody and you know, a couple times a year, talk to somebody about it, that's probably not going to get somebody's attention. But, I mean, it's an interesting thing that, you know, if guys out there are interested in doing that, it wouldn't hurt. I mean, it wouldn't be that hard to do. I would just need to know that, one, you're doing it. Two, there would have to be an agreement about what it is. So there would have to be a terms of agreement on this thing, where if somebody wanted to, however they were going to sell the lure, whether it be on, you know, word of mouth or websites or YouTube or anything like that, and they had that code, they would have to be, everything would be split up, you know, it's the cost of the product plus the shipping, and then say you got 10% for selling it. If you only sold a couple of orders, that's not going to be very much. You go out and sell a couple of thousand, that could be some serious bank for both sides, and that would be a win-win for everybody. So, I mean, it definitely could work. Most companies, though, just to be honest, in the trapping industry, is pretty archaic when it comes to how they track, how they sell. They're very distrusting of having other people come in. Because the trapping industry, just to be honest with you, is one of those industries where everybody thinks they've got $1 million idea and they want everybody to pay them for it, but no one really wants to do anything to get it. You know, it's one of those type things. People come up with a product and they're all fired up about it, and then 6 months later, they don't want to make them anymore for whatever reason. So bigger companies have to deal with that on a large basis. And because of that, it makes them where they don't trust someone saying, I can do this or whatever. It's you're going to have to kind of prove it. Like, if you're going to call up Ralph or Sean at F&T, which I don't know if they'd be interested in doing something like this or not. You know, you were to call them up, if I was going to try to pitch this, I'd probably call them up and go, you know, I've got a YouTube channel that you'd already want to have started and have traffic on. I've got so many subscribers. You could do a podcast or something like that. You got a couple of different websites talking about trapping lure and different things like that. You know, whatever it is, you give demos at some of the shows. You give, you know, whatever you're going on. You know, you could do a website on being the, you know, the South Alabama Coyote Man or something like that, and you know, getting into maybe the wildlife protection side as far as giving information out like that anyway. So you've got these people that you're in contact with because of whatever it is you're doing, and then if you were going to talk to Ralph or Sean at F&T and go, I've got so many subscribers, so many hits, these people are coming to do this, that, and the other. I'm not interested in selling lure, but I'm interested in helping you sell more of your products, whatever that would be. If I had a code, which is common in most industries besides trapping, that I could give them to show you that I'm selling your product only on the ones that have the code, what could we come to an agreement on what that would be worth to you? You know, and it could be, you know, on certain things like traps, 10% of traps when they're only 20% profit is probably going to be a no. So, you know, you're going to have to, there's going to have to be some give and take on a lot of that type stuff. So it could definitely work. I mean, if that's something that readers would be interested in doing, I guess I could try to work that out with my web guy. I mean, it wouldn't hurt my feelings to have, you know, 50 guys out there pushing the product of mine, that if I got more sales and it cost me, say, 10%, and I wrote them a check or PayPal or however that would work out, that wouldn't be a bad deal. But what I do like about this is it's thinking. You know, and not all of these type things work out. You may find it very hard to get someone in this industry to do it, but you may find out that it's easier to do in the hunting industry or some other type of industry, you know, like that. It's because it's what it does. This is where you can take social capital, which we talked about, and turn it into income. So it doesn't matter if you're, since you brought up Avon, let's say that you've got a website where you're teaching people how to dye their hair pink and have purple lipstick and green fingernail polish. And you've got 20,000 people that like that, and then you were to go, you know, there's a company, a smaller company that makes these products, and you go to those products, you know, those people that make that product and go, look, I've got all these people that are interested in what you're doing. I can even push your products more, but it needs to be, you know, worth a little bit of my time just besides altruism for giving you business. And most business guys are going to look at that because you're not asking them for anything except for what you earn. That could definitely be a thing to do. So very, very interesting concept there. So if you're interested in doing it with me, I guess we can try to figure that out. But I would like to have more than just one person doing that because it's just going to add more of what I've got to keep up with every month. So that's definitely a way to be thinking. So how are we doing on time? Okay, I've got the last thing that I want to talk about, which is getting back to more physical trapping here. I'm sitting out the other day, and because of my back, I couldn't do a whole lot. And I've got these things in my yard that I've been experimenting with, growing blackberries and squash and watermelons and tomatoes and stuff on. And what they are, they're fence panels that are on an angle. So I'm not going to get into all that. But anyway, what I noticed the other day is a neighbor of mine brought in a couple of cats, didn't have them fixed, and we got feral cats up the yin yang around here. And they go through, and it doesn't bother me at all because they go through the garden and they eat mice and they eat bowls and stuff like that. So it doesn't bother me that they're here. They haven't done any damage that I can tell about or anything. But a couple of these little fence things that I've got that I grew tomatoes on last year are a lot closer to the ground than some of the other ones. And what I've noticed is the feral cats are using that as an edge, even when there's 20 feet that they can go in another direction before they hit something else. They're using that kind of like the marker Jesse was talking about, and they've got a trail wore down in my grass in two different areas around these tomato panels that I've got in my yard. And then I'm down in the woods the other day, and I was looking because one of the things I'm going to be doing down on the farm is I'm going to put about a half an acre of that in the coppicing for my own personal firewood because we don't need a ton of it here. And then that way the same trees can give me the firewood and I don't have to go off my property. I'm not going to get into that either. But I'm looking around in there and I come across some trails that I didn't know was there because I'm looking at the species of trees and, you know, is it hardwood or do I need to get it out of there so other trees can grow? And I'm just kind of looking around doing the outdoorsman type thing. And I noticed these trails that I didn't notice was there. Now, for some reason in my little brain, the cat trail around that fence and the little trails that I didn't know about that's going between my pasture and the river, it got something in my mind kind of clicked. So this is just one, this is another theory type thing, guys, but it has me thinking. You wouldn't want to try this everywhere, but I guarantee there's a lot of places that if you took the time to do this, I have a feeling you would make some hot spots of your own for trapping. Now see, on my property, and it's not just my property, it's all over this valley. We've got a river going down the middle, which is nothing uncommon. You've got farmland and yards and stuff, and pretty much everybody leaves 50, 60 feet. I don't know if it's a law or what, but they leave 50 or 60 feet of trees and scrub brush and stuff like that up next to the river. Very few people actually clean that out. So you've got, say, 60 feet of animal cover where stuff is moving up and down the river. And it doesn't have to be a river. Don't get that locked into your head. But what if it was big open pastures and you had a tree line that's, say, 30, 40 feet or 100 feet across or something like that? What if you had cover that way? So it's not water-based, but it's just cover-based and it's open on both sides. Well, those two things in my head gets me thinking. There's a lot of times that I come across people that's got old fencing and stuff like that that they just want out of the way, or you could go, if you could get some stuff on sale or find some cheaper type stuff, or even maybe use some of the plastic fencing that's a lot cheaper, you know, than the metal fencing. Like what I'm going to do on my property, just because I own the property and just because it'll be easy to check, off the corner of my main fence going into that wood line, I'm going to run probably 80 feet of fence, or maybe 80 yards. No, that's not going to be a yard. Probably 50 yards of fence to the very edge of the river on a high bank. And it's just going to be one line. If it does really well, I may put out a second line. But I'm just going to, you know, zip tie to trees, a couple of stakes here and there, off cut limbs. I mean, I'm not trying to hold anything in. What I'm thinking about doing is just having an obstruction that to train the animals to go where I want to go, because there's all kind of bobcats and coyotes and gray fox and coon and stuff that's going to work up and down that aren't going to feel that comfortable being out in the open pastures. And especially when I start getting in, you know, all the fruit trees start coming on, the coon, gray fox, and all that, the numbers are going to jump up a lot. So I'm thinking about running this fence, and up next to the corner of my fence, I'm going to leave about a foot and a half opening. And then I'm going to go into the woods, and I'm going to have a couple of openings that I'm just going to cut into the fence that are, say, 4 feet tall, foot and a half wide, and then I'm going to run that over to the edge of the high bank, and then I'm going to leave an opening in that where, because that's how we take our kayaks down to the river, that we can push it to the back, and then when we're not doing the kayaking, I can just kind of move it back with a quick stake and leave about a foot and a half opening on the main trail. So I would have three or four trails cut into this fence or openings, and the animals will adjust to that. So all the coyotes, all the cats, all the coon, all that is going to be funneled to where I want to go. And the sweet thing about that is it's going to take all of the guesswork out of where to put a trap. Now, what I'll probably do is either blind set it or put a snare. You know, if I was in Mississippi doing this, and you don't have to worry about the dog issue, you know, you start putting 280s and stuff like that on these fences up next to the water, dude, you're going to be slamming bobcats so hard you're not going to know what to do. I mean, it would be so deadly to do that. And I remember talking to Scott Adams when he used to work on a duck as a duck guide many, many years ago down in Arkansas. He was saying that the coyotes, one of his best places to catch coyotes, was where they ran this fence all the way almost down into a swamp, and it just dead ended. He said every coyote, deer, everything would hug the edge of that fence, and he'd just go down there and put sets and just waylay coyotes, because they didn't have to crawl under, they didn't have to dig under. They knew it was an opening that they could go through. Nothing ever messed with them except for the one time a year when Scott apparently just did death and destruction on them. So, you know, I'm thinking about the cat here and the trails I found over there that I didn't know was there, and I'm just thinking that could be a really slick thing to do. Now, this is only going to be in places that you trap around home, of course. You would need to talk to the landowner, which I doubt very many of them would do. And if you look at the cost analysis of it, I think the last time I bought 4 foot 2x4 galvanized wire at Tractor Supply, the 100 foot roll was about, I think it was about $50. So the way I'm looking at this from a cost analysis, because you know, trapping, you need to have a ROI when it comes to this stuff. If you look at that, let's say you caught 2 bobcats and a coyote the first year that you put the fence out. Or you live in a place like Iowa and you can catch 10 or 15 coon because you've got these trails up next to the water. The first year, you're probably going to make a small profit on your investment, and then after that, it's all gravy. So sometimes the best thing is not to think about what it's costing you right now if you can afford it, or you can scrounge for it. Because, I mean, in my mind, I'm thinking of all these places where people that I can think of, I can go get old chain link fence, people threw out all kind of, I mean, just all the stuff that I've seen being out on people's farms and stuff that they'd be glad to get rid of. Or maybe even going down and talking to the metal recyclers of people bringing fence for them to call you, and then you'll pay them 20% more than what they'd get it if they shipped it off, and they'd save more money, yada, 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 that type thing. Anyway, you could get the fence, go try it in 4 or 5 different places and see what happens. Because I can tell you, a lot of the farmers that I trap on around here, they wouldn't care about that one bit. I'm also thinking about a place that's up on the mountain that is actually a tree nursery, that it's an old strip pit from years and years ago, and there's these straight up and down banks that go down where they used to dig all this stuff out, so there's big holes. And then on the top, it's flat. And then, you know, those are only probably 100-150 feet till you get out to the grass wide open where he's got these little tree plantings. And I'm like thinking there's a couple of trails that are already there, but it's so open because it's bigger pine trees that animals can move through there anyway. I guarantee you he wouldn't care if I would have string fence from the opening to the edge where they were mining, which could be a gully or anything else, and then cut some holes in there as long as it's out of his way. And then every year, if that works, just keep adding on and adding on and adding on. Eventually, you know, 5-6 years down the road, you're going to have a slam up trap line that you're not having to guess, and you've trained all the animals to go exactly where you told them to go. And that's the stuff that kind of gets me kind of giggly inside, to be honest with you, because that's the cool part of trapping, using your noggin for more hole than a hat sometimes. And thinking about the future instead of just what's going on right now, and it just kind of builds. So, you know, I don't know what you'd call this, fence frenzy, dry land, fence funnels, whatever you want to call it, but I'm definitely going to be doing that on my place, and then I'll let you know how that works and see if it's something that's worthwhile. And if you're willing to go out and try this, let us know how it's working for you too, because that's kind of the way I want Trapping Radio to work, where everybody's helping everybody instead of someone's just telling somebody something sometimes. So just keeping that in mind. All right, guys, this is going to be the end of the show. Y'all have a good week, and I will see y'all next Friday. Step outside.
Wayne. Us good old boys, we're all the same. With a big hell yeah and a whole lot of American pride. Just a little on the redneck side. Here comes, I got a steel guitar blaring out loud from a roadhouse bar. Then put a dollar in that old tip jar and play another country song. Got late night women in old pool halls, cigar smoke and barroom draws. And with them deer heads up on the wall, honey, that's what I call home. Cause I'm in fun loving, beer chugging, reckless kind. Don't take nothing, put me down when you're so enough to step outside. I like Jim Beam and a John Wayne. Us good old boys, we're all the same. With a big hell yeah and a whole lot of American pride. Just a little on the redneck side. Faded jeans and a flannel shirt. A car boots kicked up in dirt. Living fast and living free. And don't give a damn what you think of me. Step outside. I like Jim Beam and a John Wayne. Us good old boys, we're all the same. With a big hell yeah and a whole lot of American pride.